From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Public Health Radio is devoting our entire broadcast to healthcare in the besieged country of Iraq. Our guest is the acclaimed journalist, Dar Jamel, who has spent much of the last 3 years focused on Iraq. We'll discuss the state of public health there, why so little reconstruction has occurred, and who makes the decisions about Iraq's healthcare system. So stay tuned for a look at the healthcare system in the occupied country of Iraq. I'm Marvin Malik, today's host of Public Health Radio. 4 years have passed since March 20th, 2003, that fateful day the U.S. invaded Iraq. Unfortunately for both Iraq and the U.S., the initial conquest of the country proved far simpler than maintaining security and social cohesion. While the disorder and the crime and the insurgency and the civil war have all received abundant media attention, the state of public health in Iraq has received little focus by the U.S. media. Iraq's once proud health system, which boasted high quality care and free universal coverage, has been decimated. Unique among countries in the region, infant mortality and child survival have both worsened substantially over the last 15 years. Today, Dar Jamel is joining us to provide an update on the situation in Iraq with a special focus on the health sector. Jamel decided to dive into journalism in 2003 with one of the most important, difficult, and dangerous assignments in the modern history of journalism, serving as a correspondent in war-torn Iraq. Unlike most American journalists covering the war, Jamel has steered clear of the influence, the bias, and the safety of the U.S. military, and instead has chosen to embed himself with the people of Iraq to learn about the daily struggles they face. His dispatches from Iraq were quickly recognized as an important media resource, and he's now writing for the Interpress Service, the Asia Times, and his reports have been translated into a dozen languages. Jamel spearheaded a groundbreaking report 2 years ago on the crisis in Iraq's hospitals and continues to closely follow developments in Iraq's health sector. Dar Jamel, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Dar, I'd like to start off on the personal side and ask what it was that drew you to Iraq. How is it that you've ended up becoming one of the most prominent on-the-ground journalists in Iraq?
Well, it wasn't by design. I only have an Arab name because my father's side of the family are Christian Lebanese, and I'm fourth generation removed. So I was living in Alaska at the time that the drums for war against Iraq began, and I watched the media coverage and the sell job done of the war, all of the reasons given, which everyone knows now to be blatantly false lies, that I watched this being propagated by the mainstream media and decided that I would just go over and try to report on the occupation myself and do the job, best job I could to show folks back here what I was seeing over there. Prior to my ever going over there, that trip, which was about 7 months into the occupation, I had been following the situation in Iraq, particularly with regards to the sanctions. I was acutely aware of how heavily this hit the healthcare system, having entire hospitals that didn't even have access to an aspirin, for example, and massive shortages of essential supplies. And so that really had my interest up to where one of the first things I started checking into when I landed in Iraq was the situation in the hospital. So I wanted to see what was happening there since the sanctions were technically over and if there had been any improvement at all.
Approximately a year after that, you personally spearhead a rather intensive study of Iraq's hospital sector. Tell us about what provoked that study and what the findings were.
Well, as I started venturing into the hospitals in Iraq, and I went in for many reasons to find out how many people were being killed or wounded each day, and it was getting a lot of information from doctors about what they were seeing and this sort of thing. It's always a very lucrative source for journalists to go into the hospitals and see what's going on there, because it's pretty hard for that to be hidden. And what I was seeing as I went into these hospitals was just a disaster zone, that there'd been little to no recovery whatsoever from the horrible sanctions, which had devastated the health system in Iraq. And on top of that, as the violence was escalating more and more with each passing month, major hospitals, which were lacking workers as well as supplies, were being instantaneously turned into sort of combat field hospitals anytime a car bomb went off, and all of a sudden they'd have to deal with 50 or 100 or 200 patients immediately, and they were struggling under the weight of that and really just not getting by. And I was seeing this not just in one or two hospitals, but in virtually every single one that I went into, and so that's what prompted me to go ahead and do a more in-depth report on the situation of the hospitals.
Tell us how you went about constructing this report, and for example, who you interviewed and how your study was implemented.
Yeah, the report, it was done over a fairly long time span. I used information I started obtaining as early as January 2004 and then kept working on it through the next several trips I made to Iraq. So the report spans a time frame from when I was in Iraq, in and out of Iraq, between January 2004 and February 2005. But even more recent than that, because I still maintain a couple of guys I was working with in there and had them going around to different hospitals, sometimes in areas where it was too dangerous for me to go when I was there, i.e. areas south of Baghdad, and by the time I left, it was too dangerous to go north and west of Baghdad, so I had them go to some hospitals there and basically just carry on the work, asking the questions and that kind of thing. And so once that work was completed, we wanted to have, of course, as many hospitals as we could in Baghdad, and then at least one or two to both the south and the north, so that it wasn't just Baghdad specific. And once we had a total of 13 hospitals and were able to get answers from doctors at the hospitals, ideally administrators or at least assistant administrators, as well as sometimes patients inside the hospitals, to kind of cover, do a bit of a shotgun effect and cover not just what the administration's saying, but get out there on the floor and interview the average doctor that's having to work within that system and get the information straight from them. So that was really a key focus for the report.
So tell me about what the findings were of your study.
Well, right off the top, the things that I think are oftentimes overlooked here in the United States is that they hear about how bad the infrastructure is, but they don't tend to apply that to the hospitals. But I found that safe drinking water, clean water, of course, for hospitals was severely limited, just like it was for the general population. This led to so many different disease outbreaks like typhoid, cholera, even hepatitis E in Sadr City, which is where half the population of Baghdad, the capital city, lives. So 3 million people in this one area, and they were having disease outbreaks of hepatitis E. Electricity supply was erratic at best in the hospitals, keeping in mind that the average house in Iraq today gets 2 hours of electricity per day. Well, that's the same with the hospitals, so that forced most of them to be relying primarily on generators. So what happens when their backup generators failed, or if they ran out of the scarce gasoline? I interviewed doctors that had literally had patients die on the operating table because they'd be in the middle of a surgical procedure and have a total power outage and the backup generator go down, and so, of course, all their instruments would go dead, and the patient on the table, they would end up losing that patient. I had seen that incident happening several times. Once at Yarmouk Teaching Hospital, which is one of the largest hospitals in Baghdad. Other bad patterns, such as patients being too afraid to go to the hospital simply because the security situation was so bad. But that is coupled with the fact that U.S. forces, along with various militias, periodically would raid hospitals looking for fighters, looking for suspects, this kind of thing. So that would cause other people to be afraid to even stay in the hospital, and sometimes patients would leave before their treatment was even finished.
Stop you for 1 second. You said that U.S. troops would enter a hospital to look for people of concern that they thought were insurgents or terrorists or something.
Right.
Is having a military enter a hospital and look for troops, is that acceptable in terms of the Geneva Convention and the normal code of war? I'm not familiar with that.
No, that is absolutely a breach of the Geneva Conventions, that everyone is entitled to health care, no matter if they're a civilian or a fighter, or it just doesn't matter, that they are certainly entitled. It's their human rights. It is protected by the Geneva Conventions, and therefore our Constitution applies to that, since we're a signatory of the Geneva Conventions. So by U.S. troops going into a hospital and looking for suspected combatants or anyone, it's a grave breach of not only the Geneva Conventions, but our own Constitution. And that was happening rampantly when I was there, and I know it's still happening today.
Well, continue. I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
No, it's an important point, and it really leads into the next point that I was going to touch upon, was that consistently what I found working on this hospital report, as well as when I was just doing my regular reporting over there, was that the U.S. military was regularly targeting ambulances, hospitals, and healthcare workers. I have photographs on my website of ambulances targeted by U.S. snipers during both sieges of Fallujah, for example. And this has become really common, not just in places like Fallujah, but basically any time there's a city where the U.S. military faces a fierce resistance, they do start attacking the medical infrastructure. Other things that I've touched on a little bit already is chronic shortages of vital equipment, even basic equipment and medications. The administrator of Shuadar General Hospital, which is the largest hospital in the Sadr City area of Baghdad, it's a hospital that, according to him, sees roughly 3,000 people per day. He admitted to me on the record that their equipment supply situation was so, they were short of so many things that they even had to reuse IV needles. He said, "We know that this is strictly forbidden, but given the choice between someone dying or risking infection, of course we have to risk infection." And that level of shortage, is not even having rubber gloves or gauze or even painkillers, was very, very common. Other things like lab supplies, x-ray equipment, were horribly inadequate just about across the board in most of the hospitals I visited, which of course made diagnostic work not possible at all. The ambulances in very, very short supply, ventilators in short supply, which is of course a basic need in the hospitals. And also there's a short supply of medical workers. The recent report came out and showed that in 2003, just before the invasion, Iraq had 36,000 registered healthcare workers, and in 2006, that number was down to 18,000. So at least half of all registered healthcare workers have fled because of the violence, because of death threats, because of kidnappings. So that, of course, has compounded all the problems I've already touched on. Another hospital I included in the report was the disabilities hospital that made prosthetics for people in Iraq, and it was the only one in Baghdad and the biggest one in the country, and they had basically no prosthesis and lacked most tools they needed to get the job done as well. I visited the cancer ward at the Arabic Children's Hospital, and they were unable to supply oftentimes medication necessary for children with cancer. Of course, getting adequate treatment was really a bit of a pipe dream there. And even patients having to bring in their own food because the hospital's kitchen was so short-staffed and so ill-funded, basically not funded anymore, that they didn't even have the capacity to serve basic meals to patients in their care at the time. And another aspect I found, too, was that the CPA, the U.S. Civil Administration, that was formed right at the beginning of the occupation, had actually banned Iraqi companies, which had traditionally been part of the supply chain, from resupplying the hospitals. When they took control of the Ministry of Health, this caused, of course, rampant corruption and basically made it very, very difficult for hospitals to just get the basic operating tools that they needed to do their jobs.
Or one of the questions that many Americans may have is, what is causing these shortages and problems within the health sector in Iraq? One of the questions that many people may have is the whole problem that there's very poor security in the country, that we basically have failed at stopping crime and terrorism and the entire insurgency? So there inevitably will be interruptions of power, inability to do the kind of intensive work on infrastructure that would lead to a safe water supply. And I will want your comment on that, but it seems to me that not having IV needles is at a different level of problem. In other words, you don't need to do intensive infrastructure work with large numbers of workers to just import IV needles or syringes from the United States or from any other country where they're produced and just deliver them to the hospitals. I mean, that doesn't seem as onerous or difficult a task as providing a reliable power supply. What are your thoughts on that? Why aren't there needles?
Well, I agree with you that is really shows the level of disaster that's happened in Iraq. And the one core problem that we can point towards everything that we've been discussing is the lack of security, which, of course, under the Geneva Conventions, it is the sole responsibility of the occupying power in any country that it occupies. Their primary responsibility is security for the citizens of that country. And as you just touched on, the U.S. has not only have they been unable to do that, but they've taken action after action that's actually made the security worse, from backing the death squads in Iraq to these ongoing massive military operations. But the bottom line is there's no security. So that makes it very, very difficult for basic supplies to be shipped into Iraq, for the Ministry of Health to operate and get supplies from their warehouses out to the various hospitals. But another important part of this problem is the corruption in the reconstruction. It's very well known now that under the CPA, at least $8 billion went, quote-unquote, missing. Well, the Ministry of Health was tagged to get at least $1 billion of the reconstruction funds, and they had next to nothing. Even as recent as the last time I was in Iraq, and I had even interviewed the Deputy Minister of Health, who told me that himself face-to-face, that he said, no, we'd seen almost no reconstruction efforts from the Western contractors who had been awarded some of these contracts that applied in the healthcare sector. So there's massive corruption from Western companies, but also Iraqi companies. Keeping in mind, this is a basically U.S.-appointed parliament. These people are mostly expatriates. They don't have popular support from inside the country, and there's massive corruption within the Ministry of Health itself because of favoritism and this sort of thing as well. So these are really, I think, the corruption and the security are without a doubt the two main factors that have caused these problems.
I'd like to get back to that topic in a moment, but before we do, if you wouldn't mind commenting on the section of your report that describes Fallujah. Many Americans may remember that there were four Americans, I believe they were contractors, who were killed and then dragged through the streets with what appeared to be a lot of popular support. And then many people may remember that there was a battle, but I don't think that some of the details you've studied and reported on are common knowledge in the United States. So I was wondering if you could just give a little brief detail of what the relationship was between the battle in Fallujah and how it impacted the health sector there.
Yeah, and I use Fallujah as an example because it was the most blatant one that I ran into firsthand. And I'll be specific to the second siege of Fallujah called Operation Phantom Fury, which started on November 8, 2004. And this siege in particular, as I mentioned some earlier, before it even started, as in actual American soldiers entering the city itself, before that even happened, the first thing that happened was the medical infrastructure started to be attacked. In fact, Nizal Emergency Hospital, a small hospital inside the city, was literally bombed to the ground in just 2 days before the actual siege started, killing medical workers and an unknown number of patients.
And who did the bombing?
U.S. warplanes did the bombing. Bombings had been going on in Fallujah for months on end leading up to the actual siege. But just days before it began, the attacks on the medical system began with the bombing of Nizal Emergency Hospital.
Now, wait a minute. When you read about the military history, there are sieges on cities and bombardment ahead of an actual invasion, and often those bombardments are indiscriminate. But in the last Persian Gulf War, and particularly in this one, I think Americans were given the impression that the U.S. military had excellent ability to really target their weapons. And if they knew one building was an apartment building or a health center or a hospital, they would be able to spare that and go over some other structures which might be a center of insurgents. So I guess it's hard for me to understand why they would hit a hospital if our targeting is better now.
Well, my experience...
Are you saying it was intentional?
Exactly.
I guess that's what I'm getting at.
That's exactly what I'm saying. My experience in Fallujah, as well as other places around Iraq, is it is a deliberate attempt to go in and essentially collective punish the entire city. Standard operating procedure, which I've seen time and time again in Fallujah, as well as other cities like Ramadi, Samarra, Haditha, Al-Qaim, is that anytime a large U.S. military operation is to commence, the first thing that happens is the medical supplies are cut off into the city, electricity is cut, water is cut, food supplies are cut, and then the military operation begins, so that if they do wound fighters inside the city, the hopes of the U.S. military are to limit these fighters' ability to get any kind of health care whatsoever. And this is exactly what was applied to Fallujah. First, let's start by bombing the Nizal Emergency Hospital inside the city. Second, we're going to occupy Fallujah General Hospital, the biggest hospital for the city of 350,000 people. We're going to cut the bridges that link that hospital to the city. We're going to keep Marines on those bridges so no civilians can get to that hospital whatsoever. These are clearly marked hospitals. Of course, this is all violations of the Geneva Conventions, and specifically the Fourth Geneva Convention. And all of this is protected by international law, that even if it was a hospital for resistance fighters and was simply named like Resistance Fighters Hospital, it would still be a violation of the Geneva Conventions for any military to attack that hospital, because it's every human being's right to basic health care, no matter what, no matter whether they be a U.S. soldier or whether they be an Iraqi civilian or an Iraqi resistance fighter. So all of this is basically a thumbing of the nose at international law. But this is what I saw time and time again. Other things that would apply, as I touched on, is that health workers from Fallujah General Hospital were not allowed then to go into the city. They were receiving calls by mobile phones of people needing help inside the city. They were not allowed to go into the city on foot or in ambulance to get those people. That, too, is a violation of international law. Other examples that I saw were, again, just regular surgeons. I talked with one man in particular, a doctor who literally tried going in on foot and was being shot at by snipers as he was trying to get to various homes to help people. So again, time and time again, that's what I saw over and over. It's not, and that leads me to believe that it's not just an accident that, oh, there was this errant bomb that went off and bombed this hospital, but I saw time and time again doctors shot, ambulances shot by snipers, medical workers being killed, hospitals being bombed, ambulances being rocketed by Apaches. I saw this time and time again, and not just in Fallujah.
In your report, you also mentioned more briefly the Abu Ghraib prison, which, not at the time you were studying it, but since then, has become infamous for the torture that Americans and interrogators were imposing on the prisoners there. But you report on the role of the health sector, which I previously had not read about. So tell us about health services at the Abu Ghraib prison.
Well, one that I reported on even before the Abu Ghraib scandal was broke by the photos being shown on 60 Minutes 2 program in late April 2004, in January of that year, so 4 months before that scandal was broke, by the mainstream media in the U.S., I had come across a very cut-and-dry torture story, and I say it's cut-and-dry because it had essentially every element in it that the Tacuba report, General Tacuba, later released, that this type of thing was going on as far as medical worker complicity in the torture, soldiers doing the torturing, civilian contractors being involved, this kind of thing, said the sexual humiliation, the electricity being used. What it was, I'll just describe it to you to show the medical complicity. It was a man who was detained from his home by U.S. forces. He was held for a month, and this was not in Abu Ghraib. This is in detention centers up in the Tikrit area. And he was dropped off by U.S. forces with a medical report written by Lieutenant Colonel Michael C. Hodges of the U.S. Army. And he was dropped off in a coma at a Salahuddin Hospital in Tikrit with this medical report. And the purpose of the medical report, from what I can deduce, is that it was to basically cover the fact of why this man was in a coma. And if you read through the medical report, which I have a copy of, said he fell into a coma basically because he had a heat attack, which was brought on by heat stroke. A very detailed report as to what was done to try to help him. And then it ended saying, well, it looks like none of this is going to work. He's probably going to remain this way for the rest of his life. That man is still in a coma today. But what this medical report did not mention was the fact that, and I have photographic and video evidence of this and saw it myself, was that this man, in the back of his head was bashed in. He had electrical point burn marks on the bottoms of his feet and on his genitals. He had bruises up and down his body. One of his thumbs was broken. Numerous other wounds, very, very visible for even an untrained medical person like myself. And it was very, very clear that there was direct medical complicity, at the very least, in trying to hide the fact that this man had been tortured horrifically and clearly tortured into this comatose state. That type of situation was repeated an unknown number of times in Abu Ghraib. Even according to the U.S. military, over 10 of the deaths they list as have happened to their prisoners in Abu Ghraib alone were homicides. I mean, even the military listed them as homicides. And many of these had also the same medical complicity that I just described to you, and that we had doctors trying to hide what was going on, people being tortured, then brought into the doctor, and the doctor telling the people doing the torturing, okay, you can go for another 2 hours, or no, that's it, he's about to die, you should leave it right there. So this type of medical complicity throughout, I would argue, throughout the U.S. military detention centers around Iraq is rampant.
And it's your belief that that hasn't changed much? Because I know that, I assume, that we're no longer torturing detainees.
Well, that is the impression that the military, helped along by the Bush administration and the mainstream media, really tried to give people after Abu Ghraib, and that, okay, here's these few bad apples. We've got this situation wrapped up now. It's not going to happen anymore. The reality is the only thing that's changed is they've gotten a bit more strict about allowing people to take digital cameras into these detention centers. I'm still getting evidence of torture, ongoing torture, all around Iraq in U.S. detention centers to this day. Same type of stuff going on. It's just a bit more difficult to get the photographic evidence of it. But there's nothing to support that this has stopped or that the U.S. has really changed their policy regarding what's happening to the detainees.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. And our guest today is Dar Jamel. We've been discussing public health in Iraq. After the break, Jamel will provide a more in-depth analysis of what has caused the failure to reconstruct Iraq's decimated healthcare infrastructure and what the prospects are for the future. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. And our guest today is Dar Jamel, one of the most prominent journalists covering war and occupation in the besieged country of Iraq. Now back to the interview. Now, your report on Iraq's hospitals was published 2 years ago. And as you've laid out, it described a pretty dismal situation. So I guess I'd like to know if the U.S. and the various Iraqi regimes that have come and gone since then, if they've been able to make the situation better. In other words, how have things changed since your study in 2005 was published?
Things have deteriorated rapidly. Anyone who's followed the news out of Iraq, even in a cursorily manner, can see that the security situation has deteriorated drastically since the last information that we had to put into the report was there. And that, of course, has had the effect of making everything that we've already discussed so far much, much worse. More doctors have left. There's even been some more recent reports come out by the World Health Organization, who, of course, were being very, very critical of a project by occupation forces, which was supposedly to inject $200 million into the system to reconstruct 142 primary health care centers. And the World Health Organization described the results as shocking, because essentially what they found was that basic conditions like diarrhea, respiratory illness, and things along this line had caused 70% of all pediatric deaths in Iraq. And that was due to the fact that of these health clinics that the U.S. had hoped to have built, that none of them had been opened at the time of that report being done. More recently, we see even a worsening situation as far as even less supplies being available and less Iraqi doctors inside there. Another thing that's important to point out when we talk about the lack of doctors and health workers is that the crime is so bad in Baghdad today that the most conservative figures I've seen are that 30 people a day in Baghdad alone are being kidnapped. And the majority of these are white-collar workers, so that means doctors, university professors, and other professionals. And it's simply because if I'm running a criminal gang in Baghdad, I want to go after the most high-value kidnapping target I can find. So I'm going to think, well, his family's probably going to have more money, so I can exact that much more ransom. So that's made doctors a primary target. And with absolutely no state and no security left in Iraq, these people are just simply not able to do their jobs. And so anyone that's been able to has long since left the country.
And to what extent is that also true outside of the capital city, Baghdad?
It's certainly true outside of Baghdad. Depending on the city, it may not be quite as severe. In some cities, like in Basra, for example, it may not be quite as bad, although I know for sure that regarding funding and supplies and a shortage of health workers, they're certainly struck with their own types of problems down there as well. But other cities like the Fallujahs, Ramadi, Samarra, Hadithas, the Al-Qaims, these other areas that have faced repeated U.S. military operations, without a doubt, they're in just as dire straits as Baghdad.
The Bush administration has simplified its explanation for how to understand those who oppose the United States. We're being told that these are just terrorists, people who hate democracy, and it's good versus evil. But one of the things that struck me about your report and about the reading I've done preparing for this interview, actually, is that the problem is not exclusively poor security, and that, in fact, some of the policies and the approach that the United States took when they took over the country and began to function as an occupying power, that many of those policies may have led to a lot of resentment. And I guess I would like to get into a little bit of detail about what the administration was and how it evolved, the elements in the U.S. administration that was responsible for reconstructing the health sector and for getting it to function well. I'd like to know who was making those decisions, what their goals were, and then if we can also discuss the relationship between representatives of the United States and the Iraqis who were supposed to be implementing the policy. So in other words, the administration of the health sector.
Of all the reconstruction money that was supposed to flow into Iraq and bring the infrastructure back up to speed, $1 billion was supposed to go immediately to the Ministry of Health so that hospitals could be rebuilt, they could upgrade supplies, bring in new staff if necessary. And at the time I did my report, when I interviewed the Deputy Minister of Health, he said that they had received almost none of that funding, and they were literally in a position of begging for funds from the U.S. authorities to so that some of that work might take place.
And you're saying that still hasn't been distributed? Or
no, it has not. What I've seen is the majority of those funds never got distributed whatsoever. And again, we don't know exactly where they went. I don't know of anyone that knows exactly where, for example, that $7 billion that under the CPA went, quote unquote, missing. So nobody knows if Westerners took that or if the money was distributed, but it went to corrupt Iraqi officials or expatriates. Nobody knows for sure what happened to that money, but what we do know for sure is it did not get to where it needed to be in order to upgrade the health system so that people could go into a hospital someplace and get the treatment that they needed. Without a doubt, that was at least the propaganda that was put out there by the Bush administration, is that here's this roughly $18.7 billion that's slated for reconstruction. This will include the health sector. But time and time again, what I found is that that money just wasn't getting where it was supposed to be. Instead, we had tens of millions of dollars of contracts being awarded to groups like ABT and Associates, for example, and other Western groups. And when you check and see...
ABT is an American medical consulting group, isn't it?
That's correct, right. I believe they're out of Massachusetts.
And they have expertise on Iraq? They speak Arabic? What do they bring to this?
Well, I can't say that they have any expertise on Iraq. I can just say that they were awarded contracts worth over $10 million, possibly over 20, but I'll be conservative and say I know for sure over $10 million. And when you check and see what groups like this did, it's very difficult to find out what they did. And that's why I went straight to the hospitals to find out what they saw, what was happening. Because, for example, I had an interesting conversation with the spokesperson for USAID in Baghdad, and I was asking him very specific questions about these companies who were awarded these contracts. I just wanted to see what was happening, show me something good, and I will report it. And he couldn't show me anything good. He said that when I pushed him on the question, he said, no, it's not our job to micromanage these companies. We're just interested with the end result, and their contracts aren't up yet, so we don't have anything to report. He didn't have anything to tell me that they'd done. Instead, he threw a few figures at me of how USAID had distributed wafers and things like this to pregnant mothers to try to keep their calorie count up. But as far as really showing me projects that it had been complete or at least even begun that would improve the situation for the healthcare industry in Iraq, he just couldn't show me anything. And then I hadn't seen any proof from these companies that were awarded these contracts. There just wasn't any proof on the ground to back up that they had actually accomplished anything.
These subcontracting companies that received U.S. money that was supposed to be going to reconstruct the health sector, these companies, the ones you mentioned in the report, sounded like they were all based in the United States. And I'm just was wondering, you also mentioned in your report that obviously, since security is a major obstacle to reconstruction in Iraq, we all know that, I would assume that the insurgents are going to go out of their way to target Americans and maybe to a lesser extent other Westerners, but maybe they wouldn't to the same extent try to target Iraqis or people who look native. So you pointed out in your report that a lot of the American contractors used lack of security as their reason for not being able to complete their projects or even start projects. But you briefly mentioned at one point that the obvious thing to do based on what I just said would be just to award contracts to Iraqi companies or Arabic companies. But you briefly mentioned that they weren't even allowed to do that, and it just seems so appalling that it's hard to understand that. Is that actually the case?
Most of the time that was the case. That's what I found. There were some exceptions. There were some Iraqi companies that were awarded kind of the more minuscule projects. Another thing that happened, too, is that I don't want to sound as though I'm only critical of the U.S. companies who got these contracts. While I'm critical on those companies that deserve it, it's also worth noting that these companies that got these contracts, they would literally subcontract them out sometimes. So there were instances where a company would have been awarded a multi-million dollar contract, decided they don't want to run the risk of trying to do any of the work themselves because of the security situation. And then they would subcontract that out to an Iraqi company, of course, skimming a lot of the money off the top, sometimes more than 50, off usually more than 50%, actually, and then giving the subcontract to that other company to go out and do the job and then leave it at that. So that translates on the ground to there was literally no oversight whatsoever over these companies that were awarded these contracts, whether they be the Western companies that were awarded the initial biggest contracts or the Iraqi companies or companies from other Arab countries who were subcontracted out. There was literally no oversight. So what often happened is these companies would simply say thank you very much, pocket the money, and just be on their way. Other times they would go do extremely shabby jobs of the work. If we talk about any of the reconstruction that was begun at some of the hospitals, it was lackluster jobs, oftentimes very, very expensive paint jobs on the outsides of hospitals, but nothing being done on the insides. This was the case at Baghdad Medical City, which is the largest medical complex in the country. And when I was in Iraq during my last couple of trips I watched it get this nice pastel blue and pink paint job on the outside of it. Meanwhile, inside, it was a complete disaster zone. They had two functional elevators out of six. They didn't have functional wheelchairs to come collect people from their cars to bring them into the hospital. They lacked doctors. They lacked supplies. They lacked painkillers. So this was often the case, too. Yarmouk Hospital that I mentioned earlier, same thing. They got new desks delivered to it. They had a new nice white paint job on the outside of it. And inside, it was another total disaster zone. So that was a very common outcome with the corruption that was inherent in all of this contract process.
You mentioned earlier that the original Iraqi government was basically appointed by the Coalition Provisional Authority, otherwise known as mostly the U.S. And so the decisions that the Ministry of Health made are in reality mostly U.S. decisions, or if the Iraqis didn't agree, we wouldn't fund what we didn't agree with, because basically the money for all this is really coming from the U.S. Is that not true? And I guess what this question is getting at, how powerful are the Iraqis themselves involved? And is this basically functioning as a colony? I guess a sort of colonial relationship where the U.S. really runs the show and we impose a government. Now, they've had an election since your report came out. So now, theoretically, it's a democracy. We've heard that a lot. So can you just comment on the power of the Iraqis in this whole decision-making process about contracting and about the health sector's reconstruction?
Right, and that's a really important point, because we need to be very clear that the Coalition Provisional Authority, while it existed, Paul Bremer was described even by Adnan Pachachi, an Iraqi man in the Iraqi Governing Council, which was all U.S. appointed. Pachachi described Bremer as God, that he signed all the checks, he made all the decisions. Nothing happened without his approval. So he was basically a civilian dictator of the country while the CPA was there. Of course, under the CPA, the U.S. appointed the Iraqi Governing Council, which was 25 people, all directly appointed by the United States, nobody else. And then during the so-called transfer of sovereignty on June 28, 2004, Paul Bremer signed all of his authority over to Ayed Alawi, who is a CIA asset. He's on the CIA payroll. He has been for over a decade, and he became the interim prime minister of Iraq. So all of that power went to him, and he was strictly following U.S. orders, would not make any move without U.S. approval, whether it be U.S. military operations or contracts being given out or things of this nature. This then, he held that post until the elections occurred on January 30, 2005. It must be very clear about these elections in that the U.S. did not want to have them at that time. They knew that a Shia government would take control, so they went into damage control mode, and they made sure that they would have people in that government that would abide by the key U.S. wishes, which were, one, rewrite the oil law, which we've just seen today. A new draft oil law has come out, which is going to allow Western companies to operate inside of Iraq's oil infrastructure and get a cut of the profits. And two, things like the Bremer orders were signed into law under the transitional administrative law, and these are still in place, even though we do have supposedly a popularly elected government in Iraq. The laws of the country were already changed before that government even took office, which is, of course, another violation of the Geneva Conventions, because it's illegal for an occupying power to change the laws of a country that it occupies. And so all of these laws are already there. They're set. The damage was done, and here we are. And this current government, let's be very clear, that the people that were elected, people voted for them because they were promised before the election took place that these people would immediately call for a timetable for a withdrawal if they were elected. And the first thing that happened when these people took power was that there was no timetable called. If you look back at the events just after that election, Donald Rumsfeld made a very abrupt trip over to Baghdad and made sure that the people who came into power would not call for any kind of timetable, nor would they allow it to be written into the constitutional referendum, which took place in October 15, later that same year, that would disallow any access of the U.S. military to areas inside of Iraq, i.e. the bases there. It's also worth noting that every ministry in Iraq, including the health ministry, has a U.S. advisor serving five-year terms. No ministry in Iraq is going to make any big decision without U.S. approval.
One of the notable things about the healthcare system in the United States is its poor performance. That we're the only developed country with millions and millions, probably 47 million people, with no health insurance coverage, yet we spend twice as much per capita. So you could, to be generous, you could say that the U.S. healthcare system is inefficient. Yet it sounded to me like when you were describing the laws that were changed by the United States in its administration of Iraq, wasn't part of those laws to actually create a healthcare system somewhat like the United States? They were basically trying to privatize the healthcare system. Isn't that because Iraqi, I mean, you can tell listeners the history. Iraq had a public insurance, and basically the healthcare system was a free public good. So can you just give a little history and describe what the goals of the U.S. administration were?
Well, you're exactly right. You touched on this a little bit earlier, in that Iraq, particularly during the 80s, before the Iraq-Iran war got into its latter years, Iraq had head and shoulders above all other Middle Eastern countries the best healthcare system. It was a socialized healthcare system. Anyone could go in and get top-of-the-line, state-of-the-art treatment. Iraq went to great pains, the government, to send its doctors to the best medical schools in the world and then bring them back home to practice within Iraq. And bad enough money, there were no medicine shortages, so it had an excellent healthcare system. But as that war ground on and more funds were diverted away from the healthcare system, just like we're seeing happen in this country right here, right now, that the healthcare system started to suffer. Then, of course, the 1991 Gulf War was a huge hit on the healthcare system, of course, followed by 13 years of genocidal economic sanctions, where over 1.5 million Iraqis were killed, 500,000 of them, by most conservative estimates, to be children. And this was primarily because of the total destruction or near-total destruction of the healthcare system. And that has led us to a situation today where you're exactly right. My personal belief is that this administration wanted to privatize that socialized healthcare system in Iraq and start putting these contracts into these private Western companies' hands to start making Iraqis pay for healthcare, making them pay for medications, all of this stuff that used to be theirs simply because they were a citizen of Iraq. And of course, it's had a totally disastrous effect because now no Iraqi can afford to pay for just about anything they need aside from just basic survival things like clean water and basic food items. Because today in Iraq, we have over 50% unemployment and well over 70% inflation. We have almost 4 million people now who have either had to flee the country or are internally displaced. So their little project, their neo-colonial project of privatizing the healthcare sector, along with other parts of Iraq's economy, has, to say it's not worked, is being very generous, I think.
While I was preparing for this interview, I reviewed some data from UNICEF about child health. And virtually every country in the Middle East, even countries that we're supposed to think are headed by brutal, egotistical dictators, you know, countries like Syria, Egypt, which is supposedly so corrupt, and Iran, all of those countries show real improvements between the two data points that UNICEF collected, which is 1990, they present infant mortality, and then child mortality, which is number of deaths before the age of five. And for all those countries, Iran, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, there are real significant improvements over the 15-year period. But I'm not sure if you saw the data from UNICEF, but they're actually appalling in Iraq that the trends are dramatically in the other direction, with more than 2.5 times more childhood deaths and about the same for infant mortality. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a bit and tell listeners what you think the prognosis is for whether that can be turned around.
Well, those are astounding figures, and I am aware of those. And it's really not surprising if you take into account everything we've already been discussing and the fact that the situation in Iraq is getting worse by the minute. I think we should expect these figures to continue to worsen. One problem I run into when I talk about Iraq back in the United States, when I'm giving a presentation to people, even people who are sympathetic to the fact that the war is based on lies, it's done nothing but cause harm to Iraqis and people in this country, and just an absolute disaster scenario from any way that you look at it. Really, people forget that the situation we're talking about right now today in Iraq is just a phase of a war that began back in 1980, when the U.S. backed both Iraq and Iran during that war. They funded both countries, they armed both countries to wear both countries down, a war that killed well over 1 million people, which then, after a 2-year reprieve after that war ended, the U.S. greenlighted Saddam Hussein in the infamous meeting that April Gillespie had with Saddam Hussein, where he asked what the U.S.'s response would be if he invaded Kuwait. And he was told by her 3 different times in the same interview that the U.S. has no opinion on Arab-to-Arab issues. And so he was green-lighted to invade Kuwait. He did. This was the justification used for the Bush 1 war against Iraq, a war that devastated Iraq's infrastructure with bombing campaigns, which then continued on through the 13 years of the sanctions on a near-daily basis. And then that was the Iraq that this war began against, a totally shattered country with almost nothing left of its infrastructure, people literally starving to death. And then now we have a brutal occupation, which according to the Lancet, a study that's now grossly outdated since it was conducted last July, the most recent Lancet report, of course, published October 11 of last year, shows that 655,000 excess deaths as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And that is the situation that then we look at these statistics of child mortality, the situation with infant mortality being as atrocious as it is. When you look at it in that context, here we are essentially in the 27th year of a long multi-phased war that this country has led, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, against the people of Iraq. Those statistics then really aren't that earth-shattering when you look at this is the Iraq today, where it came from, particularly after the time of the sanctions. And it's really not that big of a surprise that these figures are so disastrous and will continue to get even worse.
Are you planning on doing any more reports and follow-up on this?
I do, and I have done some more recent news stories. They are on my website in my hard news section about the healthcare situation and what is happening there. And I do continue to follow it using my sources inside Iraq, and will continue to follow the healthcare sector best we can.
Well, one last question. More journalists have died in Iraq than in Vietnam or, I believe, any war, possibly including World War II.
That's correct.
So are you safe over there? I'm concerned about you.
No, it's absolutely the bloodiest war ever for journalists, and all journalist committees and watchdog groups around the globe agree that it is the single worst place on a planet to work as a journalist. And I've actually made a decision that I'm unable to go back there myself because I don't believe in embedding with the military, and all of my Iraqi colleagues over there have said, don't come back, you'll get us both killed. So I relegated myself into kind of a more support position now. When I cover Iraq, I do what I can to support my colleagues who are over there getting the information out and basically work as their researcher and their editor and in order to just facilitate them getting the job done. I think we're in a position now as Western journalists that the situation is so bad that we have to kind of put ourselves in a backseat to Arab media, who they're the only ones left on the ground now who can actually go around and get information from the front lines.
Well, Dar Jamal, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jamal's 2005 report on Iraq's hospitals, including updates from Arabic language media outlets about Iraq, are all available at Dar Jamal's website, dar.org. That's dahr.org. Information on child health in Iraq is available at the UNICEF website, unicef.org, and the World Health Organization's website, who.int. also contains useful information on public health in Iraq. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.